Good evening. This evening we are going to discuss the four dharmas of Gampopa, which is something we have been reciting at the beginning of meditation every week. Would you please recite it with me now? Grant your blessings so that my mind may be one with the Dharma. Grant your blessings so that Dharma may progress along the path. Grant your blessings so that the path may clarify confusion. Grant your blessings so that confusion may dawn as wisdom. First of all, we're going to be discussing this because it is extremely pithy, condensed, and contains basically the entire path of Buddhist teaching. That is, we could take it line by line, and instead of giving 10 minutes per line, we could give it 2 hours per line, or 6 weeks per line, or expand each one into a year's course or whatever. We can unfold it as much as we want, and therefore it's worth paying attention to, and it's worth saying even before we understand it, so that it starts to penetrate our minds. So first of all, who was Gampopa? He was a Tibetan, and I've given you the years of his life. We know quite a bit about him. He was definitely a historical person. We have books that he's written. We have many teachings that he has written, and quite a few of them have been translated into English. He was a physician. He was married. He had children. And he was thoroughly trained in a school of Buddhism called Kadampa. And that school is the school that traces its lineage back to Atisha, and it's a school that, of Buddhism that is concerned with compassion, and it's where the Lojong teachings that we have previously taught have come from. If you haven't heard of that, that's no problem now. There was a plague in that part of Tibet, and he lost his wife and his children in spite of the fact that he was a trained physician. And his wife, when she was dying, asked him not to marry again, so he honored this and became a monk. And it was in that state of mind that he arrived as a student of Milarepa, another great Tibetan teacher. In turn, his main successor was a man who became known as Thusen Kempa, knower of the three times, and started what we call the Kagyu school of Buddhism. And he had a successor, and so on, right down to the time of our teacher, Chogyam Trungpa, who we heard the Dharma from. So this is called lineage, and it works just the same as you can say you have an ancestral lineage of a bloodline sort. There are ancestral lineages of teacher to student. So we didn't just pick up these teachings from the book. We heard it from our teacher, Chogyam Trungpa. He received these teachings from his teacher, and he received it from his teacher, and actually there are several lines, but there's one main one. So the lineage goes back to Gampopa, it goes back before that. And the significance of lineage is that we don't just take something out of a book and try to guess what it's about. It's actually the case that we knew someone who knew someone who knew someone that goes to Gampopa. And we do know all their names. And there are times when we can actually introduce you to some of them. But not tonight. So as I said, these four lines are very compact. They could expand into the entire collection of teachings if we want. They're good to hear even when you don't understand them, because that starts it soaking into your mind. Our understanding of each line can grow in time. So what I'd like to do today is to take it line by line. There's only four lines, and we can actually stop and discuss each one of them. So there's some new people here. I'd like to keep this as simple as possible and not start to branch off into other Dharma teachings, which these people have not had. So we want to keep our vocabulary very simple tonight and start to talk about how we can actually relate with these teachings in our own experience. What can this mean to us, to you, to me? So the first line of the four dharmas is, grant your blessings so that my mind may be one with the Dharma. So you might ask, what does it mean, grant your blessings? Who is the you? Who is granting blessings? Well, we could say that it's all these teachers of the lineage. We could say that it's protectors who are more states of mind than actual historical people. We could say all of those things. And so the question comes up, well, how can people who lived in the past and died grant us blessings? Are we appealing to something godlike outside ourselves? And the answer is no, we're not. We are basically supplicating what is really our own wisdom. But we can be so limited in what we think our mind is that we can't see that wisdom. We can't quite get it. So by allowing it to be temporarily external until we have progressed to the point where we no longer see a distinction between internal and external, because our mind is so vast, we can try to relax and let it be, and eventually the question doesn't even come up, it doesn't matter. Does anyone want to comment on that?
So I actually have started doing this at home.
Yeah.
I told Emily, I have my brother got me very small, like it's about this big Buddha.
Yeah.
That I have on the windowsill, so I'd look. And when you guys explained a few weeks ago, you said it's really your own Buddha nature, and I thought, well, that's small enough that could be my Buddha nature out there and in here at this, like it would fit inside of my chest, the statue. So sort of look at it and think of it as, you know, sort of it's moved out, but it could be in here as well. And that kind of, and that, but it is also outside of me, that it's not inside, it's not outside, but it could be both.
And we're not sure how vast we are, what's inside and outside. Yeah.
Right.
Yes.
Your implies that it's something separate from. Why isn't it our?
Grant your blessings.
Why isn't it grant our blessings?
Well, the blessing can't come from our egotistical idea of who we are.
I'm not saying our. I didn't say my. Our. Oh, you are. Why can't it be our? All of us. All.
All of us? Okay. It can be. We can relate with it that way if we want, but we're not going to change the chant.
No, I just was wondering what that was.
Okay. We can leave the interpretation a really open question.
Because I guess I would see it as sort of whatever universal energy source is.
Okay.
That's either in or that we are part of it.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, okay. In fact, our here is not a bad idea either. the collective wisdom of the group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, yes.
I'm thinking the word grant is sort of interesting. Just like it couldn't say, give. So I wonder what grant means, like you're having requested for something. A grant is like you're getting a grant. You have to earn it.
We'll fill out a lot of paperwork.
Paperwork.
It's just like the land grant. Well, okay.
Get recommendations.
I'm not a Tibetan scholar, so I can't tell you, I can't expound on how the translators chose their words.
Well, the grant is basically to bestow.
Yeah.
So you're asking for your the fundamental wisdom mind, which is, beyond only what we get to a reference point of one person. It's intrinsic to ourselves, it's also intrinsic to everything, but it's latent, this fundamental Buddha nature. We're asking our Buddha nature and the fundamental Buddha nature itself to grant the blessings of being able, that's basically what that refers to. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So, you might also ask, what are blessings? What do we need? Do we need... Are they permissions? Are they forgiveness? It's not any of those things. Blessings are basically the wisdom we need to relax and open our mind and actually understand. Blessing is a flow of wisdom. We aren't sure where it's coming from yet, but a flow of wisdom. Grant your blessing so that my mind may be one with the Dharma. I'm trying not to bring in too many words, maybe three of them in the first line, and hopefully not more than one more each line. So we come to the word Dharma. And in the narrowest sense, Dharma means the teachings of Buddhism. But here it means a much larger sense. Dharma is the whole of phenomena. Reality as it actually is. So Dharma is really vast, so that my mind may understand what really is, as opposed to what I might think it is in my confused state. So it's said that blessings are always falling like rain. In fact, blessings are not something, well, it's over there, I got to go chase it, and there's the blessing. Blessings are, to use an analogy, falling on us all the time, day and night. And we might not be receptive to that. So we need to hear, contemplate, and meditate on the Dharma. And the first one is to hear. And what might be our obstacles to hearing and obstacles to receiving these blessings?
Noisy minds.
What?
Noisy minds.
Noisy minds, that's a good one. Yeah, okay. So that is part of what I'm about to say. It's a very traditional teaching to talk about three types of students and their obstacles. And actually, we all partake of all three of them at different times. And in this analogy, the student is referred to by the image of a cup. So this is the cup to receive the blessings, to receive the teachings, to receive the Dharma. So the first type of student has a cup like this. It's upside down. And as he said, the student's paying no attention to the Dharma, so doesn't get the teachings. Simple. The second type of student has a cup with holes in it. So the teachings come into the cup, and it's leaky, so the student is hearing the teachings at this moment. And then an hour later, they've been forgotten, or a day later, so the student hasn't really partaken of them and swallowed enough juice from them to start to hold his mind on the Dharma. And the third type of student has a cup which has stains of poison in it. So the Dharma goes into the cup, but the Dharma in the cup is poisoned. So this happens if we receive the Dharma and then we say, oh, this is powerful stuff I got. I can use it to calm this guy and use some of this juicy wisdom to create some deception and gain an advantage for myself. Or I can use this wisdom to wage some sort of aggression or make myself superior to someone else. So this is the poisoned cup. And if we're honest, I think we can see all three of those in ourselves at different times. I can tell you that it took quite a while for me, listening to my teacher, to feel that I was actually responsible for understanding what he was teaching rather than basking in his charisma. So these obstacles are real. So our practice is a way of purifying ourselves so that we can actually hear and retain the teachings. So our innate wisdom has somehow or other brought us all here. Every one of us has come here because our wisdom has said there's something more in our life that I'm missing. I want to start to explore that. I want to go for that. So here we are. We've encountered something which is truly profound and truly magical. And at the same time, it will take a lot of effort to realize it. It's not going to come just by being in its presence and letting it flow around us without effort, curiosity, work. So the question is, how do we actually invite Dharma into our lives? Or more precisely, what is our motivation that brings us to the Dharma? And this is actually what I'd like to discuss for the first line of grant your blessings so that my mind may be one with the Dharma. What is your motivation? I'd like to hear people ask themselves and address that. We need participation. Yeah. Yes?
My motivation is that there's something out there I don't know a lot about. I've scratched the surface. I've seen it. You know, let's say I know it sparkles and it attracts me, if you will. And there's people who, for lack of a better term, have it. And I'm interested in knowing how they got it. And whether, you know, you call it emulation or, you know, just it's a teaching. I mean, I want to be a student. And at some point in time, you know, a student becomes a teacher.
Yeah.
You know, I want to be part of this, as you said, you know, this magic, this, mm-hmm. you know, but again, my lack of understanding that prompts me to come out here and say, I liked it last week, I liked it the week before, mm-hmm. yeah, I'm getting something out of it. Don't ask me to measure it because I have holes in my cup. You know. Mm-hmm. But, you know. There's something there, and I got a late start, so I got some catching up to do.
That's great. We have all kinds of stories. You know, people who've done it very late in life, people who've done it when they were 3 years old. But it's not too late. Yes.
I'm a very, very anxious person.
Sorry, what?
Anxious. I'm a very, very anxious person, and I've been that way for pretty much my entire life. And it took me a long time to realize that, but a few years ago, I discovered meditation, and I had that first instance where I kind of realized that I wasn't my thoughts, and just being able to break away from that constant mayhem in your head was pretty powerful to me. And I've just always been intrigued by that, and I just want to continue to be more attuned with what is truly going on as opposed to what my thoughts are telling me is going on. So I also have a desire to get to a point someday where I can teach as well, because I've kind of felt the magnitude of what meditation is in my own life, and I hope to give that to someone else someday.
That's a great motivation. Right, we come with our own problem, anxiety, and we all do. And then the motivation to do it for the benefit of others is a wonderful step up. Yeah.
I see a hierarchy of things to be involved in life, and this is very true. It rings true to me, and I kind of want to follow that and kind of see how big the vision can get. Seems worthwhile. Like Alex said too, I think you just resonate a little bit different when you have that grounded. You resonate a little bit different, and it rubs off on everybody. And even without saying anything, so ultimately there's more peace.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Just understanding the nature of suffering and how that leads to compassion, or how people arrive at compassion in their lives. And it seems like it's Buddhism just seems to capture so much in my life, and that I haven't ever read in books, and I've read a lot about psychology and other things. It captures so much. It's just amazing.
To me, I always wanted to be one with the universe. In other words, I just felt all of us, other than I was just put here. I was occurred here or whatever. And unraveling all the society, I just like to be one with what is in the most basic sense. And my wish at the end of my life was to have that reflection that I became one. I became one with the universe.
Yeah, I'm familiar with if somebody's teaching something, then I should be able to learn something. I haven't got my hands around this at all.
Well, it's a pretty big thing to get your arms around. That's not a problem.
Yeah, so I've had a lot of trouble with stress and pressure, and having had periods of not sleeping well, and so I figured this would be a good way to help calm my mind, kind of calm my mind down and to relax a little more.
I also say, seeing you at First Parish, and both you have, all three of you have a quiet, sort of a calm or peace that is present, and it's reassuring. You're still experiencing all the same, for want of a better word, crap that's out in the rest of the world, but there's a way of not getting sucked into it so that you can be more, I don't know, whether it's centered or can maintain yourself and have something to give rather than getting buffeted too much. I'm not saying that very well, but
I think you are saying it very well. I think people know.
That's and plus it also fits. Buddhism seems also as a philosophy. The teachings fit with some of the neo-pagan, some of the other spiritualities that I have been drawn to. I've never liked an external telling me.
Okay. To some extent, I've been following Andrew Holacek's teaching, which will be shortly... Well, you already have a link to it. It's, and he points out that opening to Dharma, opening our mind to Dharma, is a form of purifying ourselves and making us receptive to whatever we're going to need next on the path. And we have become addicted to samsara. Through all our life we've been paying attention to looking out and not looking at our minds. And maybe through multiple lives, if we have multiple lives. And it's going to take some work to change that. He calls the process of entering the Dharma, given that we're addicted to samsara, he calls it a detoxification. Kind of interesting language. So in summary, this first line deals with our motivation to turn our mind to the listening and contemplating and meditating which we need. It's a motivation for entry, and the more we're motivated, the more and the faster we can start to get what it's about. Onward. The second line, grant you blessings so that the... Grant you blessings so that Dharma may progress along the path. So we have the notion of path. Path is journey. We're not sort of staying in one place. We're on a journey, and this journey is going to take us in different directions. It's going to take us, all of us, in different ways. We're going to encounter peaceful meadows. We're going to encounter violent storms. Our path is going to be smooth or rough or whatever it is at different times. So it's not enough to be motivated, which is the first dharma. We need to gather the strength to persevere on the path because there will be obstacles. So since everything in our ordinary environment is designed to turn us away from Dharma, advertising is training us to feel insecure and to feel that some sort of object is going to make us happy. Politicians rouse fear and anger in order to profit and lie to us. We con ourselves, we con other people in all kinds of ways. So we've been trained in an environment that isn't very good for following the Dharma. We're addicted to seeing things out there as real. We're addicted to not looking at ourselves, not looking at our mind. So it will take a big effort to take this boat and start to turn it around. And it's not going to happen overnight. and there will be difficulties in doing it. So our practice is a big help in that, and our meditation is a help because it kind of starves out the turning our mind to entertainments and evasions, because each time, what is our basic meditation instruction? When a thought arises, we acknowledge that and go back to our breath. Except when we're walking, then we go back to our walking sensation. So we're kind of, meditation is continually renouncing samsara. It's saying, okay, I'm willing to put my mind on just being here, willing to give up entertainments. So it creates a level of frustration. And it helps a great deal to be very curious about this, to try to understand the Dharma, to put energy into it. It also helps to have a group of people who have a similar motivation. So we call a group such as we have Sangha, which in practical terms could mean something like a congregation. But a Sangha is a group of people who are meeting because they have the similar intention and support each other in turning our mind to the Dharma. Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche said, the path has a lot of manual labor in it. There's a lot of magic up front, but then there's a lot of mechanics. Now this is, you've heard things like this before, surely, what they said about genius, what it is to be a great composer of music, is to have a vast vision of what is possible, and at the same time all the patience to deal with the details of notes and harmony and counterpoint and structure and everything else that makes up music. Or if we're painting or sculpting, all the different techniques and media and perspective and light effects that we need to understand. So Dharma is going to be like that too, a vast vision and a lot of detail work too. A lot of magic up front, but then a lot of mechanics. So we could have a... people want to tell me how they relate to that sort of teaching.
There's a piece of it that's confusing to me.
Yeah.
If we're saying the Dharma is what really is, I'm trying to see how it goes on the path. Like, and I think that there's a part of it that my mind is stuck with the idea that there's a truth out there, and that's what the Dharma is, this truth that sits out there. And then why would the truth have to go anywhere? And I know that's not what it really means, but I think that's how my brain thinks of what thinking about stuff like this gives you is there's a right answer.
The path is getting there.
Right, but then there's the Dharma.
Is the Dharma?
There's a piece of thinking wanting, like trying to get my head around what the Dharma is.
Yeah, we still want the Dharma to be a thing, but it isn't a thing.
Right, I know that's
yeah.
What I hear is that the knowledge we're getting, it's it's ancient and in some ways it's static, but it's going to change as we go along this path. As we hear the same knowledge, it's going to sound different from every different part of the path. So we have to kind of continue to be open to it, because we're going to encounter a lot of things that are going to try to close us off from it. So that's part of the struggle. That's part of the fight, is to stay open.
I agree with almost all of that, except that I don't think it's ancient. I think it's timeless. And one of the things it's said is that we talked about, or I talked about transmission, that is, there's a lineage transmitting something, and what's being transmitted is not some ancient knowledge. The one analogy I've heard is that the Dharma is like baking bread, and so you don't give your student some bread. The student, you're giving the student how to make bread. That is how it's constantly reinvented. So it doesn't, we don't have to believe that particular words were historically spoken. It's the magic has to be recreated all the time.
So in that way it's not static at all?
No.
Or rediscovered all the time. Mm-hmm. Discovery is probably a better word. We're not creating it, we're discovering it. It's present. It's fundamentally here already at some level, waiting to be discovered for ourselves.
What actually is the knowledge?
No, there's no answer that you're going to get in words, okay? Whatever words we can use are provisional to sort of move us along. The wisdom we're looking for is already within us and is not a verbal construct. If we could say this is it and describe it in words, that would not be it. But yeah.
Teaching somebody,
yeah,
you have to be explaining something to them for them to learn. And that's where
I think the idea of the path is that each of us goes and discovers it. So it's not, and it's, I don't know, it's different for each, where what your conditions are, what's going to make sense. So I think that's what we struggle with. That's the same struggle I'm having. It's like, there's that idea that people teach us that.
Right. It's not like school. That's the thing.
Yeah.
You know, we're so conditioned to show up and then listen to someone and then take a test on what they said. It's not like that. It's saying, you are discovering it for yourself, and it's the meditation practice that allows it to be revealed or allows you to find that open space or that possibility of being present. Because every time you're meditating and a thought arises and you let go, you're coming back to the present moment. You're noticing this difference between thinking, and then, oh, I'm thinking, and back. So you, by that practice, you're cutting a new groove in your record, and you're going on a different track.
Not everyone in the room is going to get that.
We got to get
into the digital age. Oh, sorry, especially for the young people, I know.
The other thing that is fundamental is that is intrinsic to this, to engaging on the path, is we are rewiring.
That's a good one, too.
We are rewiring our default system, which is fundamentally neurotic. This is what we discover in the process of looking at our minds. This is not a definition someone else is imposing on us from the outside, saying, well, we're all neurotic, so get with it. It's more about, oh, look at my mind. Look what's actually going on. So discovering the wiring we have, and realizing we don't have to just continually go through this, having that live us out until we drop dead, and then who knows what. We actually can change that. We have the opportunity to change. The changing actually occurs in the process of the practice of meditation itself. It's not like some special mechanical process that occurs, and you don't read it out of it.
I think you've got it.
I'm just thinking that this is probably so the meditation process can be actually laying down new neural pathways or reinforcing neural pathways.
Maybe. It's possible.
They study it that way, sure.
Yeah. People study it, yeah. Basically, it's what we have to find out, though.
Well, right. I'm remembering something I heard somewhere that said, like, babies are born with so much potential, but then if nobody could use everything that babies have when they're born. So we practice in some pathways, neural things get establish. Like if you, we would probably have difficulty learning to speak Chinese because we don't have those sounds in our vocabulary and some of these other things. So, but it's like maybe babies have some kind of an innate knowledge that we lose as we get verbal, as we kind of bring it. And we're trying, maybe we're in some ways trying to get to that knowledge that they had.
As long as we don't believe that babies are born innocent.
No. I won't go there. Nature is not a kind thing. And babies
okay.
are part of nature.
How's
that? The other thing is that we studied the skandhas earlier.
Wait, let's not get into theory here.
No, but just watching your mind, these things are, when you begin to realize the components of your mind, you begin to see what's actually going on. We all have this. This is basically, everybody has this issue. It's not like some people are exceptions to this. This is everybody's issue. This is what it means to be a sentient being. And that's why, you know, now we don't, this is something that we can discover for ourselves, again, rather than we impose it on ourselves. And the neural pathways are currently the way certain people are describing how the mind works. It hasn't, you know, it doesn't, this is just the current method. It's perfectly fine. But at the same time, these neural pathways could be understood to be the same problem, present the same problem.
Okay, let's try
to bring it
back to. Let's try to bring it back to.
Go ahead.
Yeah, to what people are experiencing.
So, do you have to be in your mind? Can you be in your heart and soul to get benefit on the path? Do you have to be in your mind?
Mind and heart are not different here in Buddhist language. Mind does not mean thoughts here.
Okay.
So, it's the same thing as heart.
Okay.
Yes?
So, speaking to the path, in my own practice, I've had experiences where, I'll be sitting and all of a sudden it's just complete clarity. Like, my mind is at ease for maybe 2 seconds, 5 seconds, whatever it is. But I tend to hold on to these moments, which I think is a detriment to the process. I think the very notion of the path gets in the way up for me sometimes, so I guess maybe how I understand that there's a the path is like the idea to be able to just observe your mind and kind of be in the present, but I think striving for that sometimes gets in my way, and I don't know if anyone can speak to that or how you can get away from
well.
Yeah, I guess it's being in a goal-driven mindset and seeing that there is a thing that you're trying to get to when
okay.
in reality it's religious.
Yeah, I understand that. So there's something we need here. The simple answer is when you realize you're striving to produce a state of mind, don't do it.
Right.
Okay. Now, that's not too easy because we all want things like that. So what has come up a lot is something like what was the line? Were you using striving for the stars? Who was using that? Aspiring to the stars. Who said that?
Aspiring to the stars.
Yeah. Which is fine. So we have big aspiration and we're reaching for it and we want that, right? Okay. We might or might not be doing it in a way that it promotes some form of self-deception. So how do we know whether our effort is a deception or not? Teachers have actually addressed this, and I think we need to know what they said. How would we know an effort to reach enlightenment which is genuine from one which is which involves self-deception? Is there any measure we can apply to it?
I would say that if you're trying to put any type of time constraints on it, then that would be a big red flag. That like, if you're really trying to make something come in any kind of timely manner, then that should kind of warn you, because I think the whole process is learning patience.
There's probably some truth to that. Yeah, I think there is. But if we look at the whole picture, not about the mechanics and about not striving, but the whole picture of what we're doing.
But is it kind of that spiritual materialism saying, like, well, look at me, I have many, many, much time that I'm so enlightened, and everybody look at this wonderful self that's so enlightened.
Right, we might recognize our own arrogance, yeah?
I think a mistake that can be made in striving to obtain enlightenment is viewing enlightenment as sort of this fixed, this body of knowledge, and I can just learn these various things, I will thereby have enlightenment, as opposed to first starting to ask the right questions.
Okay. So, what I understand from all of my teachers, and I believe that Christian mystics and Sufis and anyone else, Jungians even, will agree to this, is that a mark of genuine practice is that we grow in compassion, gentleness, and patience, as opposed to getting more hard-edged about it. I think that is fundamentally what we have to ask ourselves. But we have to persevere. So the second line, grant your blessings so that Dharma may progress along the path, is perseverance. We have initial enthusiasm. There are going to be obstacles. We need to marshal our strength to work with the path, with its grand aspects, with its unpleasant details, whatever it is, so that we're not put off when it gets harder, because it will. The weather will change, we know that. Change for better, for worse, both ways, many times. So it takes strength to persevere on the path. Anything else on that? Okay, now we get to the one we're all going to hate. Grant your blessings so that the path may clarify confusion. What does this mean? What does it mean to clarify confusion?
Is it the confusion itself, or recognizing that you are confused?
Okay, we recognize we're confused. What does it mean to clarify the confusion?
Well, something to consider is to clarify what you're confused about. Like, just asking, what don't I know? Rather than pursuing specific answers.
Okay. So it doesn't say, grant your blessings so that my mind may get rid of confusion.
I think it's seeing through it.
What? Seeing through it, yeah. Seeing through the confusion. It doesn't say, grant your blessings so that I can fix my confusion or get rid of it. Yes?
To clarify, the confusion might be to come to understand why I'm confused. Where did my confusion start? What's up with that? Why do I have it?
Okay.
I take it to be like, so like clairvoyance, like to see it. You need to see it. And then when you can see it, then you might be able to change it.
Okay, so at least we see it.
See.
Okay.
I was wondering if it could also be, much like you said, there's always all the obstacles, just so that you have to sort of keep reminding you that this is, it's not what the universe throws at you, isn't personal. I don't know, that is it.
Yeah? Mm-hmm. Okay, so, again, I'm following Andrew because I think he's such a fine teacher here. But I can find it in all other teachers. He just says it directly for us. To clarify confusion is to heighten confusion. What does that mean? Yeah. To heighten.
To heighten confusion?
Heighten it.
Right. Well, I believe that life is confusion, and the very idea that we can diminish it is a source of suffering. So I believe that once you're at one with the fact that confusion is okay and you stop trying to get rid of it, then you clarify your confusion.
Okay, but this might get kind of unpleasant here. What does it mean to heighten confusion?
Maybe you really bring it forward so that it's right there, so you're not like, no, things are fine. Like when people say, how are you doing? I'm fine, I'm fine. And you're like, I'm not fine at all. But I would say I'm fine, I'm fine, because I don't want to look at that. I don't want to look at what's not fine.
Right, so people get meditation instruction, and a month later they come back and say, this instruction is making me worse. my mind is now full of thoughts. Yeah. So, yeah, was your mind full of thoughts before, but you just didn't know it? That's one aspect of it. But it's not just thoughts, it's emotions.
Is the clarify kind of like sometimes people say that what happens when you meditate is there's all this stuff swirling around, and so you don't really see the nasty stuff that's really down there. And then when that settles, when it's sort of like the sediment settles, you're like, oh, that's what's at the bottom.
Now it's in your face.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right?
Well, or another way of putting it is you don't see anything else.
No.
And, you know, you assume that that's all there is. And you just assume that's okay because you don't know any other way. You have your good and bad in that system. Of, you know, but the fundamentally you're looking at very muddy waters. Yeah. You know.
And also, I think if you're not really looking, there's you are pushing away things that might be very fearful, or you know, there's a cover up going on all the time. And what happens a lot of times with people, after a period of time when they, you know, first there's a lot of confusion in their mind and thoughts, and then things start to settle out, and then they experience some very fundamental fear, and that's touching in to that fundamental truth that we talked about in September earlier on, about there's no solid self. And that sense of insecurity or there's a fear that arises from that point. So that clarifying confusion, I think, is allowing yourself to start to go deeper and allow things to actually come up that we don't really want to touch because it's like a live wire.
Exactly, yeah. It can bring up a lot of... Meditation can bring up a lot of fear. And we've been trained... What's our training when we have fear?
Don't think about it.
Yeah, don't think about it. Yeah, watch television...
Go
have a good time.
Go shopping.
Go shopping. Yeah,
you just
right.
Go online now.
Yeah.
I know, but it's not as fun.
Right.
Go to REI.
Join the thongs taking in Black Friday. So all this stuff is coming up, and we don't like it. And it's coming up because we're starting to actually have some wisdom, and this wisdom is giving us lots of panic because we realize that what we think we've been grounded in isn't going to work anymore. we start to see how we've been conning ourselves, how we've been conning other people, how other people have been conning us, and all the more subtle aspects of even when we say we're doing good, we're helping people, whatever, start to have a rather false tinge to them. So fear and things happening in our face are coming up. All of a sudden there's no place to hide. That's the most fearful thing of all. Meditation has taken away our ability to hide from ourselves. And that's frightening. It really is. And it's part of the path. That's clarifying confusion. What's on your mind? Yeah.
I'm just thinking, to me, what I'm taking in is it takes like ever deepening honesty, self-examination, and discarding your point of view for a new one.
Right. And notice that it is being generated by effort. It's all this thought comes up, be here. Our ability to distract is being removed. This light is shining, and this light is so intense we can't stand it. Buddhism isn't alone in saying this. Christian mysticism talks about the dark night of the soul, for example.
Freud.
A fear, yeah.
Also Freud.
Freud, yeah, right. So we're learning how much of what we do, yeah, speaking of Freud, how much of what we do and what we think is not the story we tell ourselves, but something that we were not conscious of. But meditation technique in the Buddhist sense is not about performing some kind of analysis of this cause, was this cause and this, because this happened when I was a baby. And it doesn't encourage that kind of analysis. It encourages simply being present and welcoming what comes up and looking straight at it. So that it's not like there was a separate box called the unconscious. The unconscious is simply what we've decided to pack away. There's no boundary there. And finding that there's no boundary, that the light can go everywhere, is the frightening aspect of clarifying confusion.
Maybe those are universal concepts that somebody tried to put into language. Goes back to the first one, grant your blessing so that my mind may be one with the Dharma. It's a worthwhile thing to go in that direction.
Keep going. Yeah. No, I thought you were going to sort of recapitulate. No?
Okay. No, okay. That was it for me.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah, we're trying to put something into words, and we know that words, they're not exactly, you know, as precise as we want.
Never are.
And I'm thinking of the example. I don't know who I'm stealing this from, but it's like an old man in a cave trying to explain to a blind man the light he saw from a candle 1,000 years ago. You know, it's, how do you do it? How do you explain the color blue to or Helen Keller, or, you know, and that's what, you know, I'm trying to, you know, grasp, and I know it's a very fleeting grasp, but every once in a while I get in touch with and I have that, oh yeah, you know, it's that moment of clarity, you know, that comes, and then you think, maybe I'll have another one of them, maybe it'll be, you know, tonight when I do my practice, or maybe it won't come for a while, but it's still alluring. It's still calling me, you know, to say, okay, there's something beyond what's in between these bony structures up here that have never been outside, but it's what I'm using to understand everything that's outside. And time is a construct. You know, it's there, but you shouldn't be limited by it.
That's fine. I don't see a problem there. And we aren't describing something remote and difficult to understand. We're describing something that can happen to you. It may not have happened yet.
You mentioned something a little earlier, and I really latched onto it. You talked about grabbing a live wire.
Yeah.
I did that once.
Yeah.
All right, so, you know, I can understand that, whoa, this is good stuff. You know, but I don't want to do it again.
Well, you don't want to get yourself electrocuted, but basically we are going to have to hit some kind of live wire. Because the way we normally live our lives, it's like a bunch of cows inside a pasture with an electric fence. And we've been very well trained, don't touch that fence. But as long as we follow that training, we're never going to get out of that small mind little pasture. There are barriers of fear, and it's not something theoretical. Shall we go on?
Yeah. No. 9:04.
So okay.
We want to finish up.
Yeah, so we have a fourth one. We'll finish up pretty quickly then. It's good that we've taken this long, actually. Grant your blessings so that confusion may dawn as wisdom. Isn't that wonderful? Okay.
Right.
So, well, instead of getting rid of confusion, the confusion is wisdom. We're going to use alchemy. Alchemy is magic. We're going to transmute lead into gold, where lead is the confusion and gold is enlightenment of, as manifested by Buddhas and enlightened beings. So we can actually do this. And actually, doing it is a matter of actually relaxing and having confidence that our original nature is Buddha nature, and that we don't have to do anything to our dark side, that it already is enlightened. That's not very easy to understand at all. If we don't believe it, and somehow we need to be tricked, maybe, into pushing in that direction. But why would that be worthwhile? Well, usually, we are frauds. We go around, and we have this image of who we are, and our good person, and actually, it takes a lot of energy. And we're not spontaneous, because we always have to check and see whether what we're putting out to other people or even to ourselves is what we think ought to be. And this is saying we don't need that. We can spontaneously be enlightened, and what we've been fearing all along is really not that fearful. Our ignorance can be transmuted into wisdom and complete freedom. Our passion can be transmuted into awareness of what actually benefits others. Our aggression can be transmuted into vivid clarity about the world. Our greed can be transmuted into generosity. Pride into equanimity that radiates like the sun. Envy into all accomplishing activity. So we don't have really much time to discuss this. It is about working with emotions, and we do need to address this starting in January. But if you want to say something about alchemy or what the hell were we talking about, you're welcome. But we can't say too much about it.
I'm wondering about the sense of wisdom. Is it a form of acceptance?
Ultimately, yeah. As long as it's not a limited acceptance.
Right.
As long as it's not our ego saying, well, I accept I'm a schmuck, or something like that. It's ultimate acceptance is actually confidence in our enlightened nature, and we're really afraid. We're afraid we don't have it, that we really are a bunch of messy emotions, and we can't afford to just stop guarding them. So, could we actually do that? I don't know. I have to find out. Yeah?
It seems to me, whatever experience it is to experience the world as it is, it's an observational state. In other words, it seemed to me earlier you spoke about markers being compassion and the others. And it seems to me those are values, which are, you know, impositions of what's good is okay and what's bad is not okay. Whereas an observation is a neutral. It's confusing and it dawns as wisdom as is.
Well, yeah, observation maybe, but it's beyond observation. It's actually letting loose our nature beyond the control of observing it. We have to step out of that too. It's beyond boundaries.
Yeah, so isn't are the values and boundaries?
Yeah. But observation or looking at ourselves is also a boundary. So, shall we leave that for now? Okay, can we recite the four dharmas once again, please? Grant your blessings so that my mind may be one with the Dharma.
Grant your blessings so that Dharma may progress along the path. Grant your blessings so that the path may clarify the confusion. Grant your blessings so that confusion may dawn as wisdom.
Thank you. And we are now going to dedicate the merit, which means that if there's any wisdom manifest here, and I think there is some, we're going to give it away to everyone in the world and beyond the world and beyond our galaxy and beyond whatever our mind can fathom. By this merit
may all attain perfect awakening, rising above all forces of negativity, going beyond the turbulence of birth, old age, sickness, and death. May all beings be free from the ocean of samsara.